Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Hello and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Modern technology has changed our world in countless ways. Sometimes it's easy to forget that just a decade ago, our world was a much, much different place. We are now in constant communication with each other. We have all the current knowledge in the world, literally in the palm of our hand. We all carry around a tiny computer that is more powerful than rooms full of equipment used to be just 20 years ago. And when you go out in public these days, you're almost always on camera being recorded. But that hasn't always been the case. There was a time when it was very unusual for investigators to have video footage of an actual crime taking place. Now we see crimes taking place multiple times a day by opening TikTok or turning on the news. But in the early days of video surveillance, cameras weren't very clear, and the footage was often difficult to decipher. But then new technology was invented to clean up and clarify footage from those cameras. I remember this era well. We all started learning about what a pixel was and just how important those pixels were in obtaining a clear image from a camera. Today we are talking about a landmark case, the first time in history a crime was solved using what was at the time cutting-edge software. This is the story of serial killer Frederick Evans. Let's get into it. September 15th, 2002. Our story begins near Spartanburg, South Carolina, in a little suburb near Duncan Park. This house on Park Drive was home to 55-year-old Damaris Huff and her family. Damaris was a woman who took her fitness seriously, and every morning she went out for a walk in the park near her home. The park is a heavily wooded area, but not an isolated one, as it sits near homes on the street. It's a beautiful park with picturesque views, a lake, a sports complex, and lots of trails. Residents have been enjoying the park since the 1920s, and it is, for the most part, a very safe area. On a crisp fall Saturday morning, Damaris left for her usual walk, but she wasn't back at the usual time. At first, Damaris' husband thought she might be taking a little extra time on that day, but after an hour, he knew something was wrong. James Huff contacted the police and told them he feared his wife had been injured on her walk. He even told them that he'd driven around the area where she walks and didn't find her. James told the police that he really believed he would drive up the path and find his wife sitting down with a sprained ankle or a hurt leg, waiting for someone to come and help her. But he was dismayed when he didn't find his wife anywhere. The police began to search for Damaris Huff, and before long, they found her. Damaris was laying off the trail in a thicket of bushes and trees. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. She was naked except for a pair of socks, and strangely, her clothing was gone. Police surmised that it had been taken to hide any evidence the killer may have left on the clothing, or perhaps the killer took the clothing as a trophy. Damaris was still wearing her watch, and this told police that robbery wasn't the motive for the killing. Her headphones were laying in the dirt and leaves near her body, and the cord from her Walkman was tied around her neck. It was discovered at autopsy that the killer had attempted to strangle Damaris with the cord, but it wasn't strong enough, so the killer had used his hands. Immediately, suspicion fell on Damaris' husband, James. We all know that most murders are committed by someone close to the victim, so it was natural that the police would take a look at the husband as a suspect. Investigators asked James if they could go through the house, looking for anything that might assist them. And when they did, they found something that would change the course of the investigation for a while. In a drawer in the den, police found Damaris' purple Walkman, which was missing from the scene. The cord and the headphones were there at the scene, but the actual Walkman itself was gone. How would the Walkman have returned to the house unless it was James, her husband, who put it there? Police went to James for an explanation. He told them that Damaris actually owned two identical purple Walkmans. She had taken one with her that morning, and the one the police found was the second. Well, the police didn't believe James. He offered to take a polygraph test in order to prove his innocence. We talk about this all the time. I am a broken record. Polygraphs are junk science, and no one should ever take a polygraph test. You're just asking for trouble if you do, and this case is a perfect example of what I'm saying. James Huff took the lie detector test, and he failed. Now police were sure James Huff had killed his wife, Damaris. They just had to try and prove it. James gave investigators even more ammunition against him when he had Damaris' body cremated, even when her family objected. Damaris' family wanted her buried, but James went through with the cremation. This made police even more confident that he was the killer. He was trying to destroy evidence. Just when things were looking very, very bad for James Huff, the kit from the hospital came back from testing, the sexual assault kit. The semen found in that kit from Damaris' body did not belong to her husband, James. James was innocent of this murder. So why did he fail the polygraph test? Because they don't work. When you stop and think about it, why would a husband follow his wife into the woods, sexually assault her there, kill her, and then take all of her clothing? I'm not saying it couldn't happen because we all know stranger things have occurred, but it would be very, very unusual behavior, to say the least. So now police realize they're back to square one. The residents of Spartanburg were terrified there was a killer on the loose. This is a sleepy little community, a safe community, and not one where people are accustomed to residents turning up dead simply because they went on a walk through a park. The police took the DNA profile obtained from samples found on Damaris' body, and they entered that profile into CODIS, which most of you know stands for Combined DNA Index System. It is a database that contains DNA profiles of thousands of offenders. I truly believe that one day everyone on Earth's DNA will be in a system. I think that's where we're headed, and I think if you have nothing to hide, you should care more about the fact that that database could help solve murders and help close cases than you do about some sort of weird privacy issue. The hospital already has your DNA. If you've ever had a blood test, you are entered into a system somewhere. I mean, just get over it. You know, we have bigger fish to fry. If you were one of the families that was waiting for closure on, you know, an assaulted and murdered child, for example, you would want everybody's DNA in a database. And again, if you don't have anything to hide, I don't think you should have a problem with it. In my humble opinion, which I hardly ever share here, the right of the victim to have the case closed and the right of the public to have a killer off the street trumps your right to keep your sequence of numbers private, because it doesn't do anybody good except the police. Will there also be cases that arise where people's DNA is wrongly used against them? Yes, that will happen too. I'm just saying, in my opinion, this is where we're headed. Unfortunately, in this case, there was no match in CODIS. The killer was not in the system. This was a serious blow to investigators who knew that an unknown killer, a stranger on stranger crime, was the most difficult to solve. As they investigated, police learned that there were four city workers cutting down dead trees in the park on the day Damaris was murdered. All four of those men were asked to give a DNA sample, and all four of them complied. Not only were the tree trimmers asked to give DNA, police asked all the men living near the park to give a DNA sample. Then they asked publicly for anyone who had been in the area of the park on Saturday of the murder to give a sample as well. The police really were canvassing the area and doing whatever they could to identify this killer. They even asked people from Damaris' workplace to give samples. More than 25 DNA samples were taken and compared against the known sample from Damaris' body. None were a match. Weeks went by, and then months, and then it happened again. February 15th, 2003. A call comes into the Spartanburg Police Department that a woman is missing. Relatives became concerned when this woman, Rhonda Ward Goodwin, only 32 years of age, hadn't come home from work. Rhonda was the manager of a convenience store called Cigarettes for Less. She had actually gone back to school to finish her degree in order to qualify for manager and gain the promotion. Rhonda was a hard worker who worked long hours to support her two daughters and a son. Rhonda's mother, Kathy Tessier, told police that her daughter was a very reliable person, a shy and soft-spoken person who was very close with her family. On the morning of February 15th, Rhonda got up and went to work a little early to open the store on Drayton Road. But customers started to come to the store and found it locked. Rhonda, the manager, could not be found anywhere. As Rhonda's family told the police the details, they realized this was another woman who had gone missing after being out and about early in the morning. There was far too little information to make a determination at the time, but they wondered, could this event be linked to Damaris Huff's murder? An immediate search was undertaken for Rhonda. Her family was hopeful that she would be found that day, but the day passed, and then a second day passed, and their concern grew into despair. On the third day, Rhonda Ward Goodwin's body was found. She was completely nude. Again, her watch was still on her wrist, and she was lying in an apple orchard about 15 miles from the convenience store where she worked. This time, police had something they did not have in Damaris' case, something they rarely had at all back then, surveillance footage. I'm going to play this little clip for you so you can watch what happened on the morning Rhonda disappeared. The white car in that clip is Rhonda's. You saw her pull into the parking lot of the convenience store and park the car. You then see a man walk up to her, and then the two of them stand near Rhonda's car on the driver's side and appear to be talking for a couple of seconds. You then see Rhonda get back into her car as the man walks around the front of the car, opens the passenger door, and gets inside. Back in the apple orchard at the crime scene, investigators find a large pool of blood under Rhonda's body, which told them that the murder had taken place right where Rhonda was found. Just like in Damaris' case, Rhonda's clothing was missing. The killer had taken it after sexually assaulting and then murdering Rhonda, although Rhonda was stabbed to death where Damaris was strangled. The town of Spartanburg was shocked to hear there had been a second murder. One murder was very unusual for the area. Two was unheard of. The news channels were covering the cases almost hour by hour, and everyone in the area was aware of what was happening. That turned out to be a good thing, as it often does, because it alerts people to the situation. Soon after Rhonda's body was found, a citizen contacted the police and told them that on the morning Rhonda disappeared, she happened to be driving by the orchard where Rhonda was later found. As this woman drove by, she saw Rhonda's white car parked on the side of the road. Next to the car were two people. One she described as a heavyset white woman with brown hair, which is how you would describe Rhonda. The other was a tall, light-skinned black man. As the witness drove by, she watched as the two turned away from the car and began to walk towards the orchard. This woman had no idea that she was witnessing Rhonda Goodwin's last moments of life. Whoever had assaulted and murdered Rhonda had also stolen her car. Police learned that the particular model of car, a Nissan, could be disabled remotely if the payments on the car were not made. So police asked the car company to remotely disable the car so that it could not be driven. 2 days later, Rhonda's car was found disabled with the hood up. Someone had set the car on fire, police assumed, to destroy any potential DNA evidence in the car. Even though the car had been burned, it was obvious that the radio had been removed. Police put out the word to local pawn shops and through their informants on the streets to be on the lookout for a tall black man trying to sell the model radio that was in Rhonda's car. Then people began to come forward telling police that Rhonda had been dating a light-skinned black man named Chester Donovan. They had seen Chester in the store with Rhonda on several occasions, and some of them felt that he might be the perpetrator. Chester was a teacher's aide at the elementary school Rhonda's children attended. When police pulled his record, they learned that he had a previous arrest for domestic violence. Police pulled Chester Donovan in for questioning, and he vehemently denied that he was involved in any way with Rhonda's death. Chester then volunteered to take a polygraph test, and as if we needed more evidence not to take a polygraph, Chester Donovan, like Damaris' husband, failed his lie detector test. Lie detectors also hurt the police because they send them in the wrong direction, wasting time and man hours. But in the police mind, now they have a man who resembles this man seen with Rhonda by the orchard. He knows Rhonda and he has a violent record. They brought in the witness, the woman who had driven past the orchard and seen Rhonda with her killer. They put a photo lineup of six people in front of this witness, and she immediately picked out Chester Donovan. Police felt, again, they had their killer, and again, they were wrong. Chester Donovan had an airtight alibi. While Rhonda was being abducted on surveillance, Chester was at the school where he worked. People saw him there. There was no disputing it. He could not have been the man in the footage. So that's two failed polygraphs for innocent people. I'm very opposed to the use of the polygraph, as you can clearly see. It is not a tool that we should be using in this day and age. There's just far too much evidence against the accuracy of that test for them to still be in use. I think it's a travesty that people are still being asked to undergo this junk science testing, and I think it's terrible that refusing to take a polygraph test is seen as a clue, an indication of guilt. It's bizarre to me. But you heard it here. Listen to your mom. You're getting the mom voice. Never, ever, under any circumstance, take a polygraph test. Chester Donovan willingly gave his DNA. It was not a match to Rhonda's killer's DNA. But thankfully, the police compared the two known samples, the DNA found at Damaris' scene and the DNA found at Rhonda's scene. And yes, they matched. Police then knew Spartanburg, South Carolina, had a serial killer working in the area. Investigators were no closer to uncovering the killer's identity than they were months ago after Damaris' murder, but they knew they had something that might help them. There was surveillance footage of Rhonda being abducted. It was grainy, it was dark, and it wasn't much help to them in the beginning. But one of the officers knew of a new software program being used to clean up this type of footage. This officer had seen something about the Secret Service and their success with this new software, and so the Spartanburg police requested assistance from the Secret Service. Most of us associate the Secret Service only with the protection of the president and the president's family, but they actually have a lot of other jobs. When the Secret Service was formed in 1865, it was done so as a law enforcement agency, one that chooses only the top of the top candidates to be a part of its team. At the time of its creation, counterfeiting money was a very serious problem here in the United States, and the task of uncovering counterfeiters and their product was given to the Secret Service. From then on, the organization became involved in not only law enforcement, but to some extent, science and forensic sciences. The service has remained on the cutting edge of modern investigative techniques, and the Spartanburg Police Department was hoping it could help them on this difficult case. The Secret Service was happy to help. At the time, in the early 2000s, it was still developing software that could clean up poor quality video footage, and members of the service were anxious to put their new technology to the test. It was the perfect time and case to show what this new software could do, and everyone involved was hopeful that the results would lead investigators to this serial killer. The video footage was sent to the Secret Service, and members of that team began to work with it. The first thing they discovered was that the cameras in the parking lot that caught the abduction on tape were very, very out of focus. The technology wasn't there yet to be able to refocus the footage on its own. So investigators went back to the parking lot and set up a device that shot a beam of light through the frame of the camera pointed at the parking lot. Then they photographed that beam of light to get a barometer for just how out of focus the cameras were. This would let them know how to try and make adjustments to the blurry footage. When they reached a point on the cameras where the beam of light looked perfectly round against the background, they knew that was the clearest and most accurate level of focus for the cameras. Investigators then took those settings and applied them to the out-of-focus footage, using the beam of light as a fixed pixelated point for everything else around it to be referenced. As they begin to process the footage, they see things more clearly than they did before. What had first appeared to be a conversation between Rhonda and her attacker, they now see was a confrontation. They also see that after the man walks around the front of the car and sits down in the passenger seat, his arm goes across the car towards Rhonda and he puts her car keys in the ignition of the car. Although they can't clearly see it on the tape, they realize that during the confrontation, this assailant has taken Rhonda's car keys from her. I'm sure Rhonda was in shock, and I'm sure she was just doing whatever she thought would keep the man calm so she could protect herself. And we can't blame her for that. But I think if anything, we can honor Rhonda's memory by making sure this message is very, very clear. Never, ever, under any circumstance, go with an assailant to a second location. Anytime you go to a second location with any kind of an assailant, an attacker of any kind, there is a high chance that you will not come back. If they've got a gun, they're less likely to use it if you're in a place where other people might see that happen. If they use that gun, you've got a better chance of getting help than you do in a field somewhere. Just never, ever go with anyone to a second location, even if you think that following their demands will save you. I'm sure Rhonda felt that's exactly what she was doing. And sadly, she ended up having terrible things done to her before she was then murdered in cold blood. Even with the footage dramatically enhanced, it was not possible to see the facial features of Rhonda or her attacker. The cameras were simply too far from the car. The sun hadn't even come up at the time, so on top of the poor images, the light was bad as well. The technology and the enhanced video would end up helping, though, and it was a very good thing that investigators had obtained it. We've all heard a lot about SLED lately because of the Murdaugh case. SLED stands for South Carolina Law Enforcement Division. In South Carolina, any violent offender is required to submit their DNA, and that DNA profile goes into the SLED database. I think that's fantastic, and I think more states should do this. Most are at this point, but there are still a few that don't. I feel if you commit a violent offense, you've lost the right to deny that your DNA be documented. It's a consequence of violent behavior. You're now on the radar of law enforcement. Like I said earlier, I think we're all going to be in that database before long. Because SLED has the law behind it, and it is able to document so many dangerous individuals, it was disappointing to learn that the killer's DNA was not in the database. It was also surprising. Who was this man who hadn't committed any violent acts in the past that went from nothing to murder? That was unusual. Obviously, there was the chance that he just hadn't been caught before, but investigators stated during a press conference that usually they see an escalation in violent behavior. It is more rare to have an offender with no record suddenly begin committing murders, but that's what happened in this case. It's also important to mention that the database wasn't really as organized as it is now until 2002. So this was a very new database at the time of these murders. This database had only been being used for about a year. After new laws were passed in South Carolina, the DNA database became a lot more powerful because the laws about DNA collection became more powerful. But if this offender had committed crimes before 2002, about the time of these murders, there was a chance that he wouldn't be in the database because of more lax laws at the time. Then police finally got a significant break. An undercover informant comes forward and tells police that a man tried to buy cocaine off of him using a radio taken from a Nissan as currency. Because police had put the word out on the streets and in the pawn shops, this informant knew about the stolen radio. He told police that the man used the street name of Snow. The informant then brought in other informants who told police that the man who went by Snow was a local man named Frederick Evans. For the first time, police had a name to attach to the killings. Police quickly located Frederick Evans' home. He lived in this house here, which was in walking distance of the convenience store Rhonda managed. They learned that Frederick Evans was 35 years old. He worked as a short order cook, and he also had a 13-year-old daughter. He had also served time on multiple occasions. He has convictions for assault and battery, and for robbery. In one of these assaults, Frederick Evans sliced a man's throat with a box cutter, and the man only survived due to sheer luck. Frederick Evans was a very dangerous and violent man. In November of 1991, Frederick tied up an 83-year-old grandmother and sexually assaulted her in front of her granddaughter, who was also tied up. So this is a very violent and despicable criminal. Just as police suspected, those convictions were before 2002, which is why his DNA was not in the system. Police bring Frederick Evans in for questioning. He adamantly denies being involved in either Damaris or Rhonda's attack or killings. Police decide to try and get under Frederick's skin. They lie to Frederick and tell him that they have shown the surveillance tape to his mother and that she identified him in the surveillance tape from the parking lot. Frederick Evans took the bait. He believed that his mother had identified him, and at this point, his whole story changed, because of course it did. Frederick Evans tells investigators that he knew Rhonda Goodwin. He says they met at her work, got in the car together, and drove off to the field to have consensual sex. There, an argument ensued, and things turned violent. He claims Rhonda tried to stab him, so he took the knife from her and stabbed her to death with it to save himself. Investigators did not believe a word of it. They obtained Frederick Evans' DNA, and it was a perfect match to DNA taken off of Rhonda's body. They then compared the DNA to the profile obtained from samples found at Damaris' crime scene. Again, a perfect match. Investigators then brought in some of Frederick Evans' friends and began to question them. Those friends told police that Frederick had been sleeping on a bench in Duncan Park the morning of Damaris Huff's murder. Damaris went walking by and was startled to see a man asleep as she came upon him. Frederick, being the predator that he is, took advantage of this opportunity. He stood, he chased Damaris, and he attacked her. Oh, that is just a nightmare, right? Especially for women. I used to go walking a lot and was always having imaginations of coming upon someone as I walked. You know, what would I do? How would I respond? Picturing this happening to Damaris is something I've always pictured happening to myself, and it is terrifying. And also why I believe in being armed and trained with a firearm. Investigators believe something very similar happened in Rhonda's case. Frederick Evans just happened to be walking through the parking lot of the store when Rhonda pulled up to open it. She was just there to do her job. And because she happened to be at that particular place at that particular time, she crossed paths with this monster and it cost her life. Again, terrifying. The randomness is terrifying. I always think of Israel Keyes when I think about how random these kinds of kills are. If you remember from that episode, Israel Keyes would travel across the country and bury these kill kits, he called them, 5-gallon buckets full of weapons and ropes. And then when it fancied him, he would just return to the site of where one of those kits was buried and sit there and wait for someone to come by so he could kill them. If you happened to walk by when he was waiting there, you were dead. It's horrifying. With all of this information, police were able to obtain an arrest warrant for Frederick Evans. He was put on trial and he was sentenced to death. For many years, people believed that was the end of the story and that years down the road, we would be hearing about Evans' execution. But they were wrong. 2014. Frederick Evans had been making appeals year after year, but in 2014, some of his claims took hold. He was able to find some attorneys that put him with a well-known psychiatrist, and she administered an IQ test to Frederick Evans. She claims that Frederick's IQ is below 70, which makes him intellectually disabled. Then there were a lot of claims made about ineffective counsel, and apparently some of those claims had merit as well. There were some serious allegations leveled at the prosecutor, this man named Trey Gowdy. I've seen Trey Gowdy in several interviews on different cases. If you were to look up the definition of a cocky, good old Southern boy, there would be a photo of Trey Gowdy there. I'm probably going to get in some trouble for saying that. He went on to become a member of the House of Representatives for South Carolina, and he was heavily criticized when he became a part of the investigative body on the Clinton-Benghazi situation, that nightmare. He was very theatrical, and he overused partisan terminology a lot. He came off caring far too much about his party's politics and his own image, more than he actually did about the soldiers and the actions in that terrible event. So think what you want. Frederick Evans' new attorneys basically accused Trey Gowdy of knowing that he had put an intellectually disabled man on death row. Now, I don't know that Trey Gowdy would actually care about that, to be honest with you. He's a win-at-all-cost prosecutor, but he denied it nonetheless. You know where I sit on this issue? The death penalty becomes very muddy for me when applied to people with severe intellectual disabilities. However, I would need more than one psychiatrist hired by the defense to prove intellectual disability, in my humble opinion, that again, you never get. Well, there must have been more, because in 2014, a judge overturned Frederick Evans' death sentence, citing his intellectual disabilities. Now prosecutors were left to ask the courts for a new sentence. Frederick Evans ended up taking a plea deal for life without parole. He will live the rest of his life in prison, and he will die in prison, and that's exactly where he belongs. He should never be let out, under any circumstance, intellectually disabled or not. This is what Frederick Evans looks like today. He is a model prisoner who has earned culinary certificates and who has worked as an electrician's assistant while incarcerated. I don't particularly care what he does in prison, as long as that's where he stays. And I want the families of Damaris and Rhonda to know that our community is keeping their names alive and their memories alive, and that we will never forget what happened to either of them simply because they crossed paths with this monster, Frederick Evans. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I sure appreciate you being here. I just love interacting with you guys, and I am so grateful for your support. Hit the like button if you like the video. Subscribe to my channel if you want to support me. And of course, you can join my Patreon for a couple bucks a month if that's what you want to donate. You can help us start to gather donations for cold case DNA storage testing. That is the ultimate goal. Stay safe, my friends. Be kind to each other. And I will see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.